From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. In this episode, we go to the Missionary Training Center in Provo, Utah, where Mormon missionaries take world-class language courses before spreading the gospel abroad.
I felt like a deer in the headlights on the first day, but now I can understand about 98% of what the teachers are saying to me.
What happens to kids when a parent goes to prison?
My mom is a single parent of 7 kids. Once my dad went away, this put a really big financial strain on my family.
And guitarist Tom Chang serves up a fusion of jazz, classical, and South Indian music. And it rocks. That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. On a beautiful, sunny Wednesday, I'm at the Missionary Training Center in Provo, Utah. I'm here for Arrival Day at the largest language training school for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
All right, see ya.
Work your butt off.
The Missionary Training Center is widely recognized as one of the best language instruction institutes in the world because what they do here is truly extraordinary. In a matter of weeks, these enthusiastic young students around me will be speaking foreign languages fluently enough to spread the gospel. Every year, about 36,000 students come here before they leave to spread the Mormon faith. Among the roughly 300 new arrivals is Lindsay Christensen from Wyoming.
Work hard.
We'll see you in a year and a half.
Love you.
How do you feel to be here? Are you excited?
I'm so excited.
Right now, Lindsay has no idea how long she'll be here, but the school has determined it will take her 6 weeks to learn Slovenian before she begins her mission in Eastern Europe.
Woo! Awesome! She's going to love it. I will take this for you.
The mood is like the move-in day at college, only the students are dressed in dark suits and modest skirts. How do they learn foreign languages so quickly? For our cover story today, we're going to take you inside the Missionary Training Center to find out.
Come on down this hallway.
At 8 a.m. in a small downstairs classroom, 10 missionaries start their day with a Mormon hymn in Mandarin.
E-R-Sun.
Instructor Bracken Hodges is a student at Brigham Young University next door. Like all the instructors here, he's a former missionary himself.
That's great. So we're working on the grammar structure of when at that time, and we're teaching that grammar structure in the context of teaching someone about Jesus Christ and what he did when he was on the earth. Yeah.
He has the class recite phrases like, what did Jesus Christ do when he was on earth? Once everyone has the pronunciation down, Hodges turns to individual students. 19-year-old Kevin Gibbs does his best to answer. Again, says Hodges, say the whole thing again. This time, Gibbs nails it. Next, students pair off with their companions for role-playing exercises. One student plays a missionary and the other a local, a potential convert.
He healed the blind.
He
raised the dead.
Megan Jackson is from Wisconsin. The 26-year-old has vocabulary flashcards pinned to her skirt. She's only been studying Mandarin for 5 weeks.
Oh my
goodness, I felt like a deer in the headlights on the first day, to be honest, but now I can understand about 98% of what the teachers are saying to me. I'm getting more excited as the time goes. I can do this, you know?
Kirsten Weiss is one of the few students in this class with experience in Mandarin. She studied it in college. She says the training here is way more intense.
The 5 weeks that I have been at the Missionary Training Center, I have seen people go from having zero experience with Mandarin or even learning any language to going where I was probably about my third year of studying at a university.
Wow.
It's very impressive.
Instructor Hodges says the secret is in the unofficial motto of the training center, speak your language.
These missionaries are taught speak your language, and if you don't know that word, then say that word in English, and in your language study later today, make sure and learn that word so that you can turn around and apply it the next time. As a teacher, if I see a missionary maybe saying a word wrong, if you just tell the missionary that they said the word wrong and give them the new word, it's very unlikely that they're going to remember that 3 days later. But if they say a wrong word and you say, ah, wait a second, and make them stop and go back in what they said and analyze it and realize, oh, I said this word wrong or I didn't use this right tone, then they're going to remember that word a lot more and be able to correct that error the next time that they use that word.
Just a decade ago, many universities taught languages through rote memorization and translation. The context-based approach used here is relatively new, and it's gaining traction. Betty Lou Lever is the provost at the military's Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California.
The language world is small. We know each other. So we share knowledge, even formally, through various mechanisms.
The Army's Intelligence Brigade, made up of linguists, is based in Utah and draws on former missionaries. The military trains soldiers in much the same way the church trains missionaries. They're not conjugating verbs. They're acting out real situations.
I'm not going to give you multiple choice questions, and I'm not going to give you fill in the blanks. What we're going to do is we're going to do something. So a task is something you might actually do in your real life.
But there's a difference between training soldiers and training missionaries. To study Mandarin at the Defense Language Institute takes 64 weeks. Missionaries leave the training center after just 9. And when I asked about the dropout rate at the missionary training center, they didn't know how to answer. Only a handful have ever decided to leave. A lot of people want to know the secret to that efficiency, not just the military. The missionary training center frequently entertains visitors from government, academia, and business. But there's something that's impossible to replicate outside of the church. The thing that has these kids smiling and bright as they spend every waking hour focused on their task. Student Benjamin Simpson put it this way.
Well, you know, I mean, everything we do is trying to learn by and with the Spirit. So that's really the only way you can really stand it here. We've all had discussions about how this place would be not very fun without the Spirit. So
just about every student I spoke with said the same thing in one way or another. And whether you share their faith or not, the results speak for themselves.
My father was convicted of cocaine trafficking, and he was sentenced to 15 years in prison.
That's the voice of Ifetayo Harvey, a 22-year-old who lives in Charleston, South Carolina. She's one of millions of young people who grew up with a parent in prison.
My dad went to prison when I was 4 years old, and he was released when I was 12.
Of course, Ifetayo hadn't done anything wrong, but like many children with incarcerated parents, she suffered for her father's crime. That's our cover story today, the effect on kids and families when a parent goes to prison. At first, Ifetayo didn't know her dad was in prison.
I noticed that my dad was gone for a while, but because my parents weren't married and they never lived together, I assumed that he would be back. I started receiving letters from him, and I noticed that the letters had like really, really long numbers and codes, and I thought, maybe he lives in an apartment complex. But I think it was around maybe first or second grade when my mom told me that my dad was in prison.
And how did you react to that? What was that like for you to hear?
I was really sad about it. In his letters, he told me that he loved me, he really cared about me. So it was kind of a contradiction with him not being there and me having to deal with a lot of depression or shame. It was just a really confusing time period, I guess.
A recent study from the National Academy of Sciences examined the growth of incarceration in the United States. Jeremy Travis is one of the authors of the report. Among other questions, they were asked to study the effects of incarceration on children and the families of those imprisoned. Amazingly, no one's really studied this before.
We would say as a committee that there's actually not enough research on this entire phenomenon. For 50 years from 1920 to the early 1970s, the rate of incarceration in America was stable. In 1972, it started to go up and went up for the next 40 years, quadrupling over four decades. So this is an important social question for our democracy, which is not getting enough attention from the research community, not because there's not enough interest, but because we've not been willing to pay for it.
Based on what you were able to review, do you have a sense of how the numbers of children with incarcerated parents has changed over the decades?
The numbers are quite staggering. In 1970 or so, there were 350,000 minors who had a parent in prison, and now it's well over 2 million. And that simply tracks the fact that we're putting more people in prison, and the consequences of that are pretty profound, we think, although they're not as well documented as they should be.
It seems there are some consistent observations about the effects on children and families. Can you tell us what we do know?
So we know that there's, for example, higher rates of homelessness among families when the father is incarcerated. There are poor developmental outcomes for those minor children. We know that there's greater family instability. We know that there are significant racial disparities. The rate among the African-American communities in our country is 7 times higher than among the white children in our country.
So is there a way to break that cycle?
The first way to start to deal with this problem is to have fewer people in prison. But there will always be people in prison, and we should pay attention to the collateral consequences of incarcerating those, particularly those who are parents. And young people often end up in foster care. They have difficulties in school, attachment to their peers. And all of those difficulties present challenges for the communities, the educators and the social workers and the police officers and the family members, to surround that young person with support and make sure that they are given that support as they go through a very difficult time as their parent is taken off to prison.
Ifatayo Harvey is one of the lucky ones. She had the help and support of a larger extended family. She says she had positive role models who stood in sharp contrast to the example her father had set.
Maybe even my dad being incarcerated motivated me to do the best that I could in school. So something like that wouldn't happen to me or anyone that I knew.
But in so many other ways, Ifatayo suffered from the problems laid out in the NAS study. Her father was in a prison in a different state. There were no visits, no phone calls even. The absence of her father was a big burden on her mom.
My mom is a single parent of 7 kids, and once my dad went away, this put a really big financial strain on my family, and naturally, she was very angry about the situation that she found herself in.
You know, you said you felt depression and shame. Was this something that you shared with your friends, what was going on?
Oh, no. Yeah. When some of my classmates in elementary school would ask me, what does your dad do? Most of the time I made up things to avoid having to explain. But I do recall one time when I told a friend that he was in prison, and they're like, whoa, your dad's in prison? He's a bad guy. Like, it's hard to explain that to people because there's such a heavy stigma against people who are incarcerated or formerly incarcerated.
You know, what your parents do for a living, it can affect your perspective on the world. Mm-hmm. How do you think your dad's situation has changed your perspective?
Oh, wow. It's changed my perspective a lot. Lately, I've been really trying to focus on the positive aspects. And I know that sounds weird, but I think having an incarcerated parent really teaches you to empathize more and understand people from a different angle.
Her dad was deported back to Jamaica after he was released. Ifatayo saved up enough money to make a trip there to visit when she was 16, 12 years after she had last seen him.
It was a good experience. You know, it was a little awkward at some points, but yeah. I was willing to rebuild our relationship, and it's good for what it is. My dad calls me like once or twice a week or so.
Ifatayo Harvey just graduated from Smith College and now wants to pursue a master's in social work. Her dad's experience gave her a passion for social justice, and she's no longer ashamed to talk about this part of her life.
I get power from speaking the truth of my story to others. I think once you realize that you're not alone in your struggle, it's easier to heal.
Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you for having me, Arun.
This Thursday, the eyes of the world will be on Brazil during the World Cup's opening ceremony. And there'll be a remarkable moment during that event. From Sao Paulo, NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro reports.
On Thursday, a man who was paralyzed will showcase to the whole world what a combination of science, a willing government, and dreams can achieve. The person, and who he is being kept a tightly guarded secret, has a high spinal cord injury that left him unable to move from the waist down. Next week, he won't only walk, but he'll kick a football at the opening ceremony of the World Cup. This is the scientist who made it all happen.
My name is Miguel Nicolelis. I'm a professor of neurobiology and director of the Center for Neuroengineering at Duke University.
So here we are. Tell me what it is that I'm seeing right here in front of me.
Well, you're basically seeing one of our exoskeletons, you know, that was built for this research that we're doing here in Brazil as part of the Walk Again project.
Nicolelis meets me at his workshop in São Paulo, a nondescript building with no sign in a residential part of the city. We speak next to a hulking metal skeleton, which is much larger than the average man.
This is a wearable robot.
Tell me how it works.
Yes, that's a robotic vest. As you can see, it has joints, it has a hip, it has a knee, it has ankle. It has many different innovations that you don't normally see associated with exoskeletons. First of all, it's for paralyzed people, so it has to protect the patient, and it has to provide for movements that the patient cannot make.
But the most amazing part of this is not just the hardware, but how that hardware is controlled.
So it's one of the first, the first exoskeleton controlled by brain activities.
Nicolelis is one of the pioneers in the field. He started in the late 1990s experimenting with rats, then he moved on to monkeys. And with this project, they have invented a non-invasive helmet that sends signals from the human brain to the exoskeleton.
So when the patient is here and wants to walk, he imagines, "I want to walk." And this basically activates the robot to walk.
And the robot sends back information to the brain, which has led to something which Nicolelli says is incredible.
So at the end of the training, the patients refer to us that they're actually feeling that they're walking by themselves, that there's no machine, that it's like their legs are walking again. One of the patients even told us that he felt that he was walking on the beach again.
But why is this being showcased at the World Cup? Well, the other thing you need to know about Nicolelis is that he's a soccer fan, a big one. So he said to the Brazilian government, "Hey, everyone knows we Brazilians love soccer. Let's showcase the different kind of country that's emerging now.
Let's showcase Brazil as a land where technological innovation can be put to the service of millions of people that need it."
The Brazilian government funded the project, but by the time FIFA, soccer's world governing body, approved the plan, there was only 17 months left to make it happen.
And most people thought it was completely impossible to get here.
The team, which has over 125 people from five continents working in labs all over the world, got it done. He says he'll never forget the first time the exoskeleton worked.
Well, we had a room full of scientists and engineers. Some of them are pretty hardcore people, and they're all crying. I mean, the patient and everybody was crying because the patient was saying, "I'm free again."
And while Nicolelli says his technology might someday change the lives of injured patients all over the world, what has moved him the most has been the reaction of children in his home country, Brazil. Soccer is soccer, he says, but science can change the world.
And I think that's one of the great missions of this project, is to, again, fascinate children with science. Science can be a very powerful agent of a social transformation and to do good things for humanity, for a change.
Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, São Paulo.
Now we present for your inspection the humble butler.
Good morning, Master Bruce. Rise and shine, sir.
Good evening.
I am Spartacus, the Goldman's butler.
Jeffrey, go fetch my tools. You mean your knife and fork?
In American popular culture, the butler tends to serve up comic relief. Or, like Batman's Alfred, he's more of a friend than a servant. But one show has brought back the classic butler with a vengeance. Yep, you public broadcasting types all know Downton Abbey. Mr. Carson oversees the help downstairs. Here he explains the responsibilities to another servant.
To progress in your chosen career, William, you must remember that a good servant at all times retains a sense of pride and dignity that reflects the pride and dignity of the family he serves. And never make me remind you of it again.
Since Downton Abbey made its debut in 2010, the demand for real butlers has surged, particularly in a country that has over a million millionaires.
One of the main reasons that the butler has caught fire in China is just this craze for Downton Abbey over there.
David Katz is a contributing writer for GQ. In a recent piece, he explored the lives of modern-day butlers.
These days, most of the demand is actually coming from wealthy individuals in the emerging markets, rich Russian oligarchs or vastly wealthy Chinese. In fact, because China is such a booming economy, there is a huge service industry, and even middle-class Chinese can hire servants now. But when you're talking about hiring a proper British butler, the guy in the uniform who obeys a certain protocol of service, what you're hiring is essentially a status symbol.
So the Chinese employer doesn't want a Chinese butler, though. They want Jeeves.
That's right. They want an Anglo person that telegraphs to their other equally wealthy friends that they can afford to do this.
So you went to butler school. Where is this place? What's it like?
It is in the UK, in London. And the school that I went to, and there are several, is designed to take people who already have pretty serious service experience and really take them to the next level of butling, which, by the way, is the real and proper word for what butlers do. So much of being a butler is what you don't do in front of your principals. I mean,
principal is your...
Right, that's butler speak for the very rich person whose beck and call you are constantly at. Our instructor himself, a lifelong butler, said, imagine that you're serving a dinner party for your principal and you get a call from your wife or your partner that your child is sick. What do you do? Now, almost everyone in the class, and keep in mind, these are people with a large degree of service experience, said, okay, well, you get someone else to cover. You make sure everything is set. We were all chastised. Your employer should never even know that your child is sick. Your problems, we were told, are not your employer's problems. And if you can't deal with that, the life of proper British butler is not a life for you.
Wow. So that's extreme level of dedication. How well do they get paid?
Very well. It obviously depends on the market. In places like the UK or even in the US, you'll start maybe at $30,000 a year and then quickly work your way up to several hundred thousand dollars a year once you're more established. However, if you go someplace where the butler demand is really, really high right now, such as Dubai or a lot of places in China, you can start at $60,000 a year and not even have to apprentice as an underbutler before you're head of household.
Hmm. And do they tend to stay with their principal for their lifetime, like Alfred and Batman, or is that...
Very much no these days, actually. They used to, and there's a certain pride in those that do. But because of the great demand, like with any great market, there's been a lot of jumping around lately. And this kind of bugs some of the older butlers. They see guys staying with people for 2 to 3 years and then jumping to be paid more or have an easier life.
So when you were in butler school, what was hardest about it for you? Because butling is not something you're aspiring to.
One, it was just the kind of practical ability to serve. I'm not very good at it, and I would drop arugula, and you know, it was just, I was a mess. But my bigger problem was I had a very hard time keeping my ego in check. You know, you cannot resent the people that you are serving. You have to believe in service as something beautiful in itself. And you hear them often say, we serve, but we're never servile. They really believe in what they do. And oftentimes, they believe they know more than the nouveau riche employers that have hired them, that it's their job to impart a certain wisdom to these people. And so that's why if they feel like their boss is just hopeless, oftentimes they'll walk away and get another job.
David Katz is a contributing writer for GQ. His piece, The Real Butlers of the 0.001%, is in the May issue. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Alan Rabinowitz speaks for the jaguars. The renowned zoologist and conservationist is responsible for the world's first jaguar sanctuary. His books about big cats have sold millions of copies. Now he's written a picture book about his childhood. It's called A Boy and a Jaguar, and begins with the first time Rabinowitz saw a big cat.
The first time I saw a big cat was when my father took me to the Bronx Zoo when I was about 4 years old, I believe. And I went into the lion house, the big cat house, which they had back then, cage after cage of big cats, of lions and tigers and jaguar. And it was after that first instant, even at that young age, I knew that this was to be my home away from home.
Now, you have a stutter, and our listeners would have no idea about that. But as a child, it was pretty debilitating for you. But you could talk fluently to animals. Tell us about that.
Well, I was born with a very debilitating stutter. I have a severe stutter. I still stutter now, but now I have the tools to control it, and I'm controlling it now as we speak. But when I was a young child, there was no control. And my kind of stuttering were the blocks, solid blocks, not just the repetition. So in trying to get the airflow and the words out, I would turn red, my body would spasm. I was put in special classes in school for disturbed children because they really didn't know what to do with me back then in the New York City public school system. So ever since I was a child, I had the idea that I was broken. Now, that was to human beings. What I discovered was when I was with animals that I could talk to them alone. I could be myself. And my father saw that, and he took me to the zoo, to the Bronx Zoo.
And that served as the inspiration for your life's work, that you became the voice for these cats.
It's kind of interesting how life works. I mean, as a young child, there was one particular animal that I felt the closest to, and it was a lone jaguar. It sat back there in its enclosure, in a corner, watching, while all the other cats would come to the bars and roar and vocalize. The jaguar just watched everything. It used its sound, its voice sparingly. But I would go up very close to the cage, and eventually it would come over, and it would pace back and forth in front of me. I made a promise to that jaguar. If I ever found my voice, I would try to find a place for us. I would try to be their voice and find a place for us. And I had no idea as a child what I even meant by I'll find a place for us. I think I was just trying to calm myself as much as associate with the animal. But I truly, it came from the heart.
Yeah, well, I mean, and you delivered on that promise. You literally made a space for jaguars. You're responsible for them having a protected area. But to do that, Alan, you had to speak in some of the most high-pressure situations one could imagine. How did you conquer that?
Well, fortunately, by that time, it wasn't until I was a senior in college when my parents heard about an experimental clinic, and that clinic ended up giving me the tools to manipulate my mouth, my tongue, my lips. Even with my controls, if I was in a very high-pressure situation and I got really nervous or scared, I would go back to blocking and stuttering quite a bit. So I was really worried that first time in Belize when I had to appear before the cabinet and try to fight for the world's first and only jaguar preserve. But all I kept on thinking to myself is that I made a promise.
And that moment of triumph when you're speaking in Belize, it's rendered beautifully in this book. Why did you decide to turn your story into a children's book?
Well, believe it or not, as simple as this children's book was, all my other books are hundreds of pages. This book seems very simple in its appearance, and yet it was hard to write because I didn't want to write it as an adult telling the story of my childhood. I wanted to go back inside and pull that child back out, which has always been in there. But that child is a broken child, or at least a child who thought he was broken. And that was painful. I remember crying as I wrote this book. It's even painful now reading my own story because I never wished any young person to go through something like that, that much pain.
It's hard to read it without crying. And the wonderful thing is it does end triumphantly. A lot of young kids struggle with speech problems, you know, stuttering and a whole host of other issues. Have you shared your story with kids before this?
Not in a large platform. If I was walking on the street and I heard a child stuttering, I was always torn between whether I should go speak to the child or speak to the parents and offer help and advice. Some people don't often take that in the right way. But I felt just like I wanted a voice for the animals, I needed a different voice for the children. And this book gives me that voice because I feel, while this is a book of my childhood and it's about a boy that stutters and it's about jaguars, it's not just about a boy that stutters. Mm-hmm. All children at some point in their life go through periods of feeling misunderstood or shut off from the human world, whether they have a real disability or just something inside themselves that's not quite like everybody else. And I wanted this book to speak to all of those children because I don't think adults realize, unless you've gone through it as a child, what a lasting mark such pain leaves on a young person.
Alan Rabinowitz studies jaguars. His new picture book is called A Boy and a Jaguar. Alan, such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
If you're just joining us, this is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. World music DJ Beto Arcos is back with a stack of music he's been calling In Brass We Trust. Now, Beto, you told me this band is called Slavic Soul Party, but so far it doesn't really sound like a party that I'd want to hang out at.
Oh, just wait a couple of minutes, and this thing starts to build and build. This is Slavic Soul Party.
There we go. That sounds like a party now.
This is an amazing band. They're based in Brooklyn, New York, but their style is after the sound of the brass bands from the Balkans. As you can hear now, it's an explosion of brass instruments.
Now, I don't know a lot about this, but there's a great tradition of Balkan brass bands.
Absolutely. In fact, there's even a film actually called Brasslands that documents all of the brass bands that come into this area of Serbia, the town of Guča, where they come every year to participate in a big sort of festival competition of brass bands from around the world. And this is one of these bands, Slavic Soul Party. Again, from New York, so you have, of course, a mix of what New York is, not just the Balkan sound, but the funk, the soul, the R&B, all of the stuff that makes great music just exciting.
Once again, that's the band Slavic Soul Party with a track called Brasslands. Beto, what next?
Next, a band from Romania, where there's also a big tradition of brass bands and gypsy music, Roma music. This is from a band called Fanfare Ciocarlia, accompanied on guitar by a jazz musician from Canada, and they do something really interesting. Let's take a listen.
Definitely got kind of a gypsy Roma dance feel to it.
That's right. It's sort of a swing tune because, as you can hear, you have a guitarist who plays sort of like a Django Reinhardt type of guitar, the Manouche guitar, but he's playing it with this brass band, so it's like a big contrast between the two because he's got a little instrument, so to speak, and then the loudness of the swing music of the brass band that's playing with him.
So is this traditional, or are they coming up with their own kind of thing, mixing different traditions?
They play all kinds of different musics, but this is not the typical music that they play. They play a lot more sort of gypsy-influenced type of music, Roma music, if you will. But here, they, you know, in order for this to work, they had to kind of adapt their sound to the guitarist, because it's, after all, a collaboration.
And you mentioned Django Reinhardt, the great gypsy guitarist, and you can definitely have some of that feel in this part. That's music from Adrian Russo and Fanfare Chocarlia. I'm speaking with Beto Arcos. He hosts Global Village at KPFK here in Los Angeles. So our theme is brass band music. You've got an outfit called BRM, and I'll let you say this.
This is a band from Oaxaca, Mexico, from the mountains. It's called Banda Regional Mije, which is sort of the acronym for BRM, Regional Mije Band, if you will.
I've never been to Oaxaca, but I feel like a real sense of place in this music.
Absolutely. Oaxaca has one of the greatest traditions of brass bands anywhere. There must be anywhere between 400 to 500 brass bands in the state of Oaxaca. This is one of them. And it came to the attention of a lot more people because of an American musician named Stephen Brown, who many years ago was the head of the band Tuxedo Moon from San Francisco. He moved to Oaxaca 15 years ago and began to make connections with musicians there, and then he wanted to do something with this band in particular because he felt that they were so special. He plays with this band as well. This is a 16-piece brass band, and they sing in their native language, Mije, one of 16 languages spoken in Oaxaca.
And what is he singing about here? What's the song?
The song is all about keeping the tradition alive, and they are.
This is an outfit called BRM, and so I don't butcher it, Beto, can you...
Absolutely. It's called Banda Regional Mije, which would translate as Regional Mije Band, or Mije is an ethnic group from Oaxaca.
Beto, we have time for one more. What do you got?
This next one is a really interesting mix. This is a project called La Internacional Sonora Balcanera. Mainly one DJ producer who brings together all of these musicians from Mexico City, and they create something completely new, influenced by the music of the Balkans. But in this case, we're going to hear the sound of the northwestern part of Mexico, a brass sound that you hear in Los Angeles a lot.
Kind of music that gives you happy feet.
Absolutely, yeah. This is club music. This is dance music. This is the kind of stuff that, you know, over the last 5 years, it's taken off in Mexico. This great interest and bands have come up with the sort of Balkan music meets Mexican music sound.
Beto, say the name of that band for me one more time.
La Internacional Sonora Balcanera, which would translate as something like the International Balkan Sounding Band.
That's Beto Arcos. He's the host of Global Village on KPFK here in Los Angeles. Beto, as always, a pleasure.
Great to be with you.
Again, you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. To call Tom Chang a jazz guitarist feels inadequate. He's gorged on rock music, played with R&B singer Luther Vandross, studied at the feet of South Indian percussionists. The man has tinkered with so many different styles, it's hard to say where he fits, as if any musician had to fit anywhere. Take this example. The first track on Tom Chang's debut album is a nod to Spinal Tap, Goes to 11. And at the risk of being obvious, you should play this loud.
Yeah, that's the idea. It's sort of an homage to all the, you know, the hard rock, heavy metal bands I used to listen to when I was a younger kid, so yeah, it's meant to be played at 11, if not 12.
Talk about your background a little bit. You were born in South Korea, but you moved to Canada when you were pretty young. Did you listen to a lot of rock and roll growing up in Toronto?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my sisters, I guess, were the earliest influences. I'd wake up to all this music blasting over the stereo, so I got exposed at a very early age to the Beatles and Joni Mitchell and all the great bands of the late 60s and early mid-70s. And then, you know, I started getting into music later on, actually, when we moved to Vancouver. So that's when I started picking up the guitar and immersing myself, more or less learning rock and all the guys that I really loved hearing at the time.
So you started out as a rock guitarist?
Yeah, well, more or less. I mean, the person I studied with actually trained me classically. That was great, learning how to read music and get a sense of pitch and all that sort of stuff. And then that was the music that really influenced me and that I really had a passion for and gravitated towards. So that's when I really started getting into rock. And then as an extension, blues, all those guys like Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page, they're all quite blues influenced, so eventually I made that leap.
Yeah, and we can hear a lot of these influences in your playing, like the track Barcodes. Am I hearing some Zeppelin there? The top really makes me think of Dazed and Confused, except for that sort of weird cross rhythm you have going.
I guess, I don't know where all this stuff comes from. It just sort of seeps in, so definitely some Led Zeppelin, definitely Jeff Beck. Bill Frisell is a big influence, and I kind of wrote that piece for this dance company, and they actually never used it, but at the time I was heavily listening to Bill Frisell and quite influenced by his stuff. Definitely some contemporary classical influences, just trying to break up the stuff so that it wasn't just a straight blues. I mean, it's in seven, so that kind of throws a little wrench in it from the start.
Odd meter.
Exactly. But without trying to sound, you know, like an odd meter, that's the whole idea.
I'm talking to guitarist Tom Chang about his album Tongue and Groove. Speaking of odd rhythms, South Indian music plays a big part in this. I mean, you wouldn't know what to listen to, but how did you discover South Indian music?
That's a good question. A friend of mine, a very good friend of mine who's actually a finance banker, he just started picking up Southern Indian CDs. This guy had a great ear for music, and he actually started studying with Subhash Chandran, who is on the CD, on my CD.
The great South Indian percussionist.
Exactly. And it was just by pure chance. He was, at the time, my friend was living in New York City, and he would go to New Jersey where all these families, these Brahmin families, would sponsor all these great Southern Indian classical musicians and bring them over from Chennai. And it just so happened at the time that Subhash was there, and my friend hooked up with him, and, you know, shortly after that, I got into it through him. Actually, not shortly. It took another 10 years for me to get into it, but I eventually saw the light, and it's been a huge influence on me, the rhythmic aspect and just the whole music in and of itself. It's incredible music.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Chandran, because he's on the title track of this album, Tongue and Groove, and what we're going to hear is actually he starts off not playing percussion, but singing.
Ta. Tataka dinna taka dipi, a jinna taka dipi, a jinna taka dipi, a jinna taka dipi, Tarakadin, Tadin, Katanga, Takadin, Katanga, Takadin, Katanga, Takadin.
What he's doing is what's considered vocal percussion. It's called conical, and it's sort of, I wouldn't say riffing, but he's singing, and it's a vocal percussion solo.
You guys take that rhythm and start jamming on it, right?
Yeah, what he's doing is he's improvising on what's called a corvée. It's this rhythmic cell, and he taught it to me, and I actually just put pitches to it, and I found right away I just had a composition. There's a very definitive structure to these corvées.
So in the music that you've studied and covered, you've bounced from rock to blues to jazz, classical, South Indian music.
I love it all.
Yeah, it seems like you're always adding to your style. So, Tom, are you still hungry? Is there something new for your next exploration?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, right now I'm actually studying counterpoint with a teacher in New York City, and we're actually going through the Fugue system as well as studying the Schoenberg harmonic system. So I don't think it ever ends. I think it's something that you just constantly need to challenge yourself and open yourself up to, you know, new sources. Absolutely. Otherwise, I think you just sort of stagnate. And in this scene, in particular New York City, there's just so much going on. So why not avail yourself?
That's guitarist Tom Chang. His debut album is called Tongue and Groove. Tom, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
For the week ending June 8th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, Stephen Jackson, and Daniel Hajek. Patrick Murray is our technical director with technical support from Arcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.